This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
We'll start off the show today in Europe, where the European Council has just signed off on an important trade deal with China. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this deal just offers a really significant snapshot of the state of the world, where Europe is now much closer to signing a major trade deal with China than they ever were with the United States. You know, if you think about the division of the world at the moment, and you've kind of got the United States still as the leader of the free world and the world's most powerful democracy, and then you've got China that in many ways is the leader of the authoritarian world, alongside definitely Russia, that is, you know, really stepping up their repression, stepping up what they're doing in you know, cracking down on Hong Kong and interfering in the democracy there, putting people in concentration camps. Given this world and this kind of division of the world, it says a lot that the Europe is much closer to China. Now, the specifics of this deal, it's essentially an important but a minor trade deal that they agreed to, a stepping stone along the way to one of the kind of really big comprehensive trade deals that we've seen the EU sign in recent years with countries like Japan or Canada or Mexico, where the two sides agree to recognize each other's geographic indicators. So, you know, this is champagne can only be called champagne if it comes from the Champagne region of France. You know, feta cheese has to come from the right part of Greece and all of the and meet certain characteristics before you can call it feta cheese. These kind of restrictions. But by signing this, it's a clear sign that China has gotten much closer to a full trade deal than the United States ever got. Europe and the U.S., they're not really working actively on a trade deal right now. They were when President Obama was in office. That the activities calmed down a bit now. But they never reached this stage. And they never signed off on that. And then they're pushing further. There's been news this week about China and the EU agreeing to accelerate an investment agreement by the end of the year, and that in a lot of ways will be an even bigger trade deal. So you're seeing a big statement of where China is in the world and where China is even just economically.
So the timing of this strikes me as really remarkable. You know, the mask has really been coming off China in recent months, as you mentioned, with a lot of their just egregious human rights abuses, and it's become undeniable just how duplicitous and dangerous the Chinese Communist Party is. So for Europe, there are just so many excellent reasons right now to actually stand against China. But instead, we see them drawing closer with these deals. Why do you think this is happening right now?
Yeah, that's a great point, because you could look at Britain, another power that has been drawing closer to China, and they've backed away over the last couple of months as all of these different bits of news has come out and coronavirus spread around the world, and not that's, you know, China has not behaved greatly in that either. And so Britain has backed away from doing trade deals while Europe hasn't. And so it is a, you know, if Europe's not going to back away from China now, are they ever going to back away? And I think, you know, no, they're not. They've shown that they're going to stick through this through thick and thin. And Geopolitical Futures had a good article where they traced a lot of this back to Germany. It's in Germany's interest to do a trade deal with China. They're an exporting powerhouse. They export to a lot of countries, and a lot of places that they export to, their economies have been struggling since 2008. You know, they used to export a lot they still do export a lot to the United States, but some of that has been slowing down since the 2008 financial crisis. They would export a lot to Southern Europe, and that's been slowing down. They need another customer, and China is there, and it's critical for Germany's economy to keep doing that trade. And so you've seen this massive increase in European trade with China, but really behind that is a massive increase in German trade with China. So as of 2019, China was the second largest export destination from the EU. So that's after the United States. Over the last 10 years, EU exports to China have doubled. And then, but a third of total EU trade comes from just one country, Germany. So you know, it's all part of their economic interest at the moment.
And in light of Bible prophecies, greater trade between Germany and China is actually exactly what we're expecting.
That's right. And that's what makes this subject so exciting for me to watch. I mean, God is always giving his church new understanding about the Bible. And you would expect that from, you know, if you believe in a God that's alive and living, well, you know, you would expect his church to be growing in truth, growing in understanding. And so just this is something that we've been talking about just in the last 10 years that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory was first talking about around 2010, 2011, that you have this prophecy in the Bible in Isaiah chapter 23 that talks about a mart of nations. And that prophecy, it talks about Tyre, which in that context is referring to a European economic power doing all kinds of overseas trades and having these merchants traveling around the world. With Kittim, which in biblical prophecy refers to China, and with Tarshish, that in biblical prophecy refers to Japan. So a very specific prophecy. And he was first starting talking about that around 2010, 2011. And there wasn't a huge amount of evidence for that then. And then since then, just with some of those stats that I've read, you've had the European exports or trade with China doubling in the last 10 years. And you've had Europe signing the largest ever trade deal in history with Japan. And now you're seeing this, where Europe is now much closer in economic terms to China than it is to the United States. It's much closer towards a trade deal with China. You know, you can see the alliance that's talked about in Isaiah chapter 23 taking shape. And it's been really exciting to watch that prophecy be fulfilled, watch this trade block taking shape. And you see that in quite a significant way this week. I think you can see very clearly now the outlines of the Mart of Nations, the outlines of this economic alliance that includes the EU, China, and Japan, and that very deliberately excludes the United States. And a great place to go to learn more about this is Trumpet.com managing editor Brad McDonald had an article a few years ago called Trade Wars Are Imminent. And he goes through some of what Mr. Flory wrote about this Mart of Nations prophecy and shows you what the Bible says about it.
We will include a link to Mr. McDonald's article, Trade Wars Are Imminent, in the show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Richard. For this next story, we'll stay on the topic of China to take a look at how the nation is infiltrating the United States through our universities. For this, we'll turn to Andrew.
Chinese industrial espionage is one of the biggest threats to America, and that was really highlighted in a dramatic way over the past couple weeks. On Tuesday, the former chair of the Harvard Department of Chemistry was charged with accepting bribes from the Wuhan Institute of Technology. That sounds pretty concerning. We've heard a lot about the Wuhan and the type of technology going there, so it sounds like a dodgy place. But what he was doing specifically is it looks like the Wuhan Institute of Technology was giving him $50,000 a month to work in a program called the Thousands Talents Plan. This Thousand Talents Plan was basically to recruit U.S. students, U.S. scientists to work for China. And they've got the former chair of the chemistry department at what's arguably the most prestigious university in the United States helping them do that. I don't know particularly if it's illegal to accept money from the Wuhan Institute of Technology, but it's definitely illegal to accept money from that institute and then lie about it to the IRS, which is what he was doing. So it just raises the questions like, well, what are you trying to hide that you don't want the university or the U.S. government to know that you're accepting these funds? and he was basically working as a recruitment officer for the Chinese universities, Chinese government, trying to pick out American students or Chinese students who'd been educated in America, who'd be willing to help China and its research and development programs, which especially coming right now when we've just closed down the Chinese consulate in Houston, Texas, because of their connections to the research and development community in Houston, funneling trade secrets into China, to now see that, like, okay, well, now you've got both the Houston consulate and some of the upper echelons at Harvard University who are engaged in either recruitment or espionage of American trade secrets that they're giving to what most people would say is America's chief geopolitical rival on the world scene right today.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting part of this is just, you know, we've seen evidence of China's spying and its theft for years now. This is not a new story. But it seems like the U.S. is only just in the last year or two beginning to recognize it. But even still, we seem to be allowing thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of Chinese nationals into the U.S. to study at some of our most prestigious universities every year. Do you have a read on why America is allowing so many Chinese nationals on U.S. campuses?
A couple reasons. For one, I wouldn't be surprised, as given the ideological alignment between the Communist Party of China and so many of the Maoist and Communist professors working for U.S. universities. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them are secretly rooting for China in this geopolitical standoff with the United States. But the other big reason is money. The fact is, U.S. universities, they charge three times as much tuition for a foreign student than a domestic student, which does make it more profitable for the universities to accept exchange students. And China in particular has really sweetened the pot through a variety of measures. You've got these Confucius Institutes that they've set up, Confucius Institutes at American universities. They're supposed to be an outreach program between China and the United States. But oftentimes the Chinese government will pay the professors working for the Confucius Institutes. So that's like a professor on university staff that you don't have to pay. Right. And then like deals like this with this Harvard chemistry professor who's getting $50,000 a month from China in addition to whatever Harvard was paying him, which was likely substantial. So, I mean, he's definitely coming very financially well off for working for both teams there. But between things like Confucius Institutes, money paid to professors, the money you can get just from accepting a Chinese student in there, it's very profitable, which does incentivize U.S. universities to turn a blind eye to some of these sorts of things. They've also had several instances I don't have time to probably get into today of like visa fraud, where they found out like a Chinese student, Chinese national studying at a United States university who's also a member of the People's Liberation Army. And lied about that to immigration officials when they got their student visa. Wow. And the fact that the immigration officials, they're fine with Chinese students studying at our universities if they want to, but they might get suspicious if they realize that, okay, well, you're actually an employee or a soldier for the People's Liberation Army. You're less likely to get your science visa if that's the case. But you'll find that People's Liberation Army is sending, there's been at least four students caught in visa fraud, I think, in the past couple months were members of the Chinese army and lied about it in order to get into a U.S. university.
Yeah, well, that's very worrying. Would you be able to place this in the prophetic context for us?
Right. Well, I mean, Richard's already talked quite a bit about this mart of nations that the Bible prophesies. And it just so happens that it looks like this leader of this mart of nations right now, I mean, 50 years ago, this was a third world feudalistic society that has become a global superpower that's standing up to the United States in just five decades, largely based on its trade with the United States and the technology it's taken from the United States. And China was unlikely. I mean, they would have made some technological developments in five decades on their own for sure. But a lot of this is just due to these programs like these Confucius Institutes that you've got so many Chinese studying at America that they've developed a lot of our technologies by working with that. So that's we've almost kind of created one of the big geopolitical rivals on there. And that is something that the late Herbert W. Armstrong talked quite a bit about. He talked about citing like prophecies like in Hosea 7 that talks about Ephraim or Israel being mixed up with foreigners, and even applying that to being ideologically mixed up with foreigners, and pointing out that like even communists, like the communist in Russia and the communist in China, these are foreign ideologies that have really weakened America, that because they've allowed it into our universities. Isaiah 2 and verse 6 even talks about this as a prophecy to ancient Israel, again getting mixed up with foreigners and going after philosophies from the East. Now, in ancient Israel's day, that's probably talking about Babylon, which was east of Jerusalem. But it is just also interesting today. Now you've got modern day Israel, and they're going after foreign philosophies that are from east of here. You could even say far east of here. But it does show just that idea, that's kind of a tendency that the Israelite nations, America and Britain primarily, have always had, is to just go after these foreign ideologies when you've got the truths of the Bible right here, and it never works out well.
We have a chapter in our booklet, He Was Right, that really gets to the heart of all this and also examines a lot of the very prescient statements that Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong made on this topic. This chapter is called The Communist Infiltration of America Was Prophesied. So we will include a link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. For the next story, we will stay on the topic of China once again, this time looking at its own neighborhood, and specifically the South China Sea. According to international law, big parts of the South China Sea belong to a number of different countries: Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, Vietnam, even Indonesia, I believe, has claims there. But China rejects all of those laws, and it claims just about the entire 1.3 million square miles of this resource-rich and just really strategically located sea as its own territory. So that's been the situation for the last several years. But this week, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, basically said he agrees with China, and that the South China Sea, including the parts of it that are lawfully the waters of the Philippines, now belong to China just because China has asserted power over them. So that was, it was during Duterte's annual State of the Union address, which he delivered on Monday. And he covered quite a lot of ground in this speech, but in one part of it, he ruled out letting the United States have greater military base access in the Philippines. The U.S. has been working toward a new agreement so that America can just be better positioned to check China's increasing power in the region, and specifically in the South China Sea. But Duterte said, quote, "I have nothing against America, but China is in possession of the property." And then he went on to say that it's basically too late to reverse China's control, except in a war scenario. Now, we've heard some of this kind of rhetoric from Duterte before, but when he's made such statements about the South China Sea in the past, the implication has been that the Philippines should not challenge China's aggression there because that would risk war, and the Philippines can't rely on America to come and help the Philippines, which the U.S. is supposed to do under the Mutual Defense Treaty. But this time around, Duterte went in quite a bit of a different direction here. He instead stressed that if America were to intervene on the Philippines' behalf, that could trigger nuclear war on Philippine territory. In part of his speech, he said, quote, "If you put American bases here, you will double the spectacle of a most destructive thing. If war breaks out, then atomic arsenals would ensure the extinction of the Filipino race." So you know, he doesn't want nuclear war, of course, and he went on to say that the Philippines needs to just call off any plan to try to take back parts of the country's territory that China has seized. So it's hard to say here, really, whether Duterte genuinely fears nuclear war or if he's only appeasing China with these kinds of remarks. But in either case, his refusal to stand up to China is consistent with an aim that we've really seen throughout his presidency, which is to move the Philippines away from Washington and closer to Beijing. And this is something that the Trumpet takes a very keen interest in, because this shift in the Philippines is actually furthering three different prophetically significant trends all at one time. The first one is the deterioration of U.S. power. That's something that's prophesied in numerous Bible passages, maybe most directly and succinctly in Leviticus 26:19, where God says he will break the pride of America's power as a result of America's rejection of him and his law. And then the second trend is the coming together of the kings of the East and the rise of China. The book of Revelation speaks about a huge Asian army called the Kings of the East that will play one of the major roles in the Third World War. And Ezekiel 38 reveals several details about this bloc, including the fact that it will be headed by Russia, with China in a position of junior leadership. So when we see Asian nations like the Philippines today preparing to align with China, it's really laying the groundwork for those kings of the East, those Asian kings, to come together. So some of the current leaders that we see in Asia right now, such as Duterte, may even be among those kings that lead their nations to join this Asian confederacy, but we don't know the specific individuals in most cases for sure. But then the third trend being fulfilled here in these modern developments is what the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles. The scriptures show that for this prophesied time to occur, there has to be a big shift of power toward China, such as what we see occurring with the Philippines, you know, capitulating to China. So we do have an article going up on thetrumpet.com about this soon. It's called "The Philippines Duterte Says Might Makes China Right." So keep an eye out for that. And then we will also include a link in the show notes today to our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, which explains all of these prophecies. Prophecies that we're really seeing being fulfilled in headlines just about every week now in detail. So if you don't have a copy of that, please order your free copy. Well, we'll take a short break in just a moment, but first we'll cover one more story here about Lebanon falling into just precipitous decline. For this, we'll go to Brent.
There's been numerous stories this week noting Lebanon's slow decline towards becoming a completely failed state. There was one July 30th in Foreign Policy. Lebanon, as we know it, is dying. And it talks about just the descent over the past particular year of Lebanon's economy, and how right now you've got blackouts that roll through Lebanon. You have about half the people below the poverty line. The lira, its currency, has lost 85% of its value over the past year as well. Many people, if they can, are leaving the country, plenty going to Europe, Canada. And it's really getting towards a point now where Lebanon is going to fail sooner or later. I think Moody's has downgraded it completely to CCC or something, so it can't really get any help from any type of loans from anyone. The IMF, International Monetary Fund, is working with the Lebanese government to try and come up with a plan to give it money, but before that happens, it has to make sure that there are a lot of changes to the governing system. And everyone in Lebanon can see this. And what's interesting, though, is that as time goes on, there are more and more voices that are putting the blame of Lebanon suffering to the political leadership, of course, but more heavily towards Hezbollah, who rules over the country right now, by virtue of its relationships with some of the other leaders in the country as well. Hezbollah, of course, is the terrorist organization that answers to Iran. It's funded by Iran in many ways, that's been fighting in Syria for the past 8 years at the behest of the Iranians. And yet Hezbollah has a pretty firm base amongst its own people, the Shiites, one of the sects of Islam. Shiites make up about half the Muslims inside Lebanon, which is about, for Shiites, about 25% of the population, a little bit under. But even though they're just 25% of the population, they do have a lot of power. And what we saw over the, what we're seeing over the past 3 or 4 weeks is that you have Lebanon going through this horrific struggle to even make ends meet to survive. And then you have some louder and louder voices putting the blame at Hezbollah's feet. And one of those voices that is coming to the front now is the Maronite leader. Maronite is a branch, kind of an offshoot of Catholicism. It's a Christian religion, the major Christian denomination inside Lebanon. About 40% of Lebanon's population is actually Maronite. So in terms of the demographics, the Maronites make up the majority, the biggest sect that is there. And what you have had up to now is several Maronite politicians that are working with Hezbollah to kind of guarantee Hezbollah's position of power in the country. And yet the patriarch himself, who is the spiritual leader, and who these politicians that are in bed with Hezbollah have to be very careful of not crossing, has come out and talked about how Lebanon is in a situation right now because of Hezbollah's growing power. Back on July 14th, he said this: "Today, Lebanon has become isolated from the whole world. This is not our identity. Our identity is positive and constructive neutrality, not a warrior Lebanon." So this is a clear reference to Hezbollah's ideal of being the party of God, calling itself the resistance. And here you have one of the religious leader, the main dominant religious leader, calling them out, saying this isn't the way that we are. This isn't the way that we're successful. Us in the West tend to write off Lebanon as an Arab state that doesn't, that you know, we just tend to think of it as a Muslim state, but it's not the case at all. The Shiites are the minority, and they live in power there by virtue of these relationships with the Christians. But now the Christian leadership is starting to turn away from Hezbollah and is starting to speak out. And even some of these Christian politicians that are previously or even still in bed with Hezbollah, they have to take a lot of warning from those comments.
Well, there's definitely a lot for us to keep an eye on there. Brent, would you be able to place this in the prophetic context for us?
Sure. And I probably should have just started with that at the very beginning, because Lebanon only has 7 million people. And most people listening to this, they don't really concern themselves with Lebanon. But Lebanon is a very important player in biblical prophecy because of the fact that its population is the only Arab state that has a huge Christian population that doesn't exist anywhere else in the Arab world. And we know, according to the Bible and prophecies found in Psalm chapter 83, that Lebanon is going to side itself with a Christian Europe. Now, this is an important prophecy because this group of nations that's going to come together, that's detailed in Psalm 83, includes a lot of moderate Arab states, all of which don't really have a Christian population at all. And yet we know that they're going to side right alongside a Christian Europe going forward. And this is an alliance that has to come together. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has noted that Lebanon really does form the linchpin, this like connecting pin between the moderate Arab states and a Christian Europe. And as Lebanon, as we start to see Lebanon siding towards or away from Iran and away from Hezbollah and being led out of that orbit, the Iranian orbit, by the Christian patriarch, we can see the beginnings of this greater prophetic alliance starting to take shape. And as Lebanon then comes into sway, more of its traditional allies in France, with France and colonial power of France and then others, we could see these it being a doorway for the other Arab states to join in as well. If people want to understand why, I urge people to understand more about this prophecy about Lebanon and why it's important, you can read the article, Why You Need to Watch Lebanon.
We'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes as well. Thanks very much for that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Please stick around.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The world is falling ever deeper in love with Germany. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Germany has been rated far and away the world's number one most popular power, significantly ahead of the United States. This is the result of a global leadership poll conducted by Gallup. It was asking, well, how do you approve of such and such a country's leadership? And around 40% said that they approved of Germany's leadership. Meanwhile, the United States figure was only about 33%. Sorry, Germany, 44%, well ahead of the United States. United States, Russia, and China were almost kind of neck and neck, right down in the low 30s. So significant approval for Germany, significant widespread popular belief that Germany should be the leading power in the world, reflected in this major poll.
So why is this significant?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting thing to look at. I think it ties in really with what we tend to discuss more when we're talking about Britain and America and this historical amnesia and this, you've got a lot of people that don't know very much history and believe that the world as it is right now under British and America or under American leadership is terrible. And those two views go hand in hand. I think if you know any history, you look at the world right now and think, well, actually, we've got it pretty good, and America's a relatively benign hegemon. If you don't have much history, you believe the world is terrible, well, who would be a good alternative to that? And again, if you're not very knowledgeable about history, you look around the world and you've got Germany, where they've got a fairly technocratic way of doing things. You know, this is what the left in the United States and Britain often want, where you've got a lot of experts in charge and the government goes along with whatever they say. And there's not a huge, I guess, looking at it from a distance, relatively stable, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, has been there for a long, long time. I think there are very significant things boiling away within Germany, but you know, on a surface level, you've got that kind of stability, and Germans have a great reputation. So I think if you're just living in the here and now and looking at the moment, there's very little to fear from Germany, and Germany makes a great candidate for global leadership. And Mr. McDonald had a cover article several years ago, 2013, talking about this, called "We're All Falling in Love with Germany," and he did talk about how there are a lot of things to admire within the German people and within modern Germany, and you can see why people think this. But then, in what he does in that article is he delves into the history. He gives some historical context. He looks at the role that Germany has played in Europe repeatedly. It looks at its geography, even just being in the center of Europe, and how it doesn't have very many geographical boundaries to prevent it from invading its neighbors. He looks at the way that people often loved Germany in the past, the attitude that a lot of people had towards Germany in the 1930s, and how you could even say the world was falling in love with Germany then. And so you look at some of this historical perspective, and then you start to think, well, you know, actually the world under American leadership is pretty good, and historically Germany hasn't always been this way, and even when it has been this way, it has changed very quickly. And then finally, in that article, he brings in Bible prophecy, which gives you the full and the complete picture. And this is something that gives you reason to warn about the world and German leadership, but also even makes sense of this idea that Germany is a well-regarded power. He goes through a lot of these prophecies that talk about Germany in the Bible that show that, yes, it has had these violent periods throughout history, and the Bible says there's going to be one more. The Bible even talks about a strong German leader coming in the book of Daniel, and it also says by peace he'll destroy many. You know, he has this great reputation. People do think that Germany is a nation that they can trust and rely. And we've got a more kind of up-to-date article on our website right now by Joshua Michels called Germany, the World's Favorite. And in that article, he talks about there's other surveys where people look on Germany as being a great peacemaker, a great country to get to go to if you want help negotiating deals and working as a mediator. And so the Bible says there's coming a time where a lot of countries will trust Germany. They'll look on Germany as a peacemaker, but that Germany is going to, through peace, destroy many nations, and that you're going to have this violence that you've seen in Germany's history reoccur. And so that article gives you a great perspective, even though it's 7 or 8 years old now, 7 years old, I guess, then on what is on this world global view of modern Germany. And that's we're all falling in love with Germany.
We're all falling in love with Germany. We will link to that and also to Josue's new article in our show notes. We really appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, Richard. Well, this week was a big one for Iran's weapons programs. For this, we'll go back to Brent.
Yeah, this week held the final days of war games for the Iranian Revolutionary or the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a terrorist or designated terrorist organization from the United States. But really, this group is at the forefront of Iran's military and often rivals the traditional military structure inside Iran. They were having great profit war games. This was the 14th one of these. They have them every single year. Except this time they did unveil a couple of different weapons. The one that everybody was writing about, as we did at thetrumpet.com, was that for the first time Iran launched ballistic missiles from camouflaged underground silos. Normally you'd see these that would take off somewhat like a rocket from the ground with your typical layout, but these ones were in the desert underneath the ground, and then you see the earth rise up before them, and then these ballistic missiles fire out. So there was footage of that, which is again something different from Iran, allows Iran to be able to hide where it places these ballistic missiles and potentially missiles that could eventually have a nuclear weapon on them. So it adds another layer of danger to Iran's nuclear program. Of course, they also did showcase a replica of a United States aircraft carrier. This is an aircraft carrier actually that was featured in the 2015 Great Prophet Games, war games, and it was dragged out to sea back then and destroyed. It has been repaired, and it was dragged out to sea again right in the middle of the Strait of Hormuz, that really narrow oil choke point through which a good 20% or over 20% of seaborne oil in the world flows out of. Every single day, they were doing their war games there, and right there was this U.S. replica of an aircraft carrier. This time it was attacked and by these speeding boats with missiles being fired from them, also some surface to ship or surface to air missiles, and then also you had, before that took place, commandos from helicopters going down ropes onto this aircraft carrier also. And so the Iran obviously uses these games to test its new weaponry and to showcase that new weaponry to the world. Of course, the fact it's doing it in the Strait of Hormuz is a provocation of it demonstrating the power it has to potentially stop seaborne traffic, or at least make it extremely unprofitable for insurance carriers to continue to insure ships going through there. If they can just make it dangerous enough, they wouldn't be able to get the insurance. And so Iran's doing that. And of course, the main adversary in this case is the United States. And this is declared from the very beginning of these games. I would add that when they did do these tests of the ballistic missiles from underground, two United States bases in the region, one in Qatar and the other in the Emirates, in Doha, or is that Abu Dhabi, sorry, they were put on alert. There were American soldiers going undercover or taking refuge just in case these ballistic missiles were sent for them. And so this wasn't just your ordinary test. It was definitely meant as a provocation against the United States. And it highlights weaponry, increasingly sophisticated weaponry that the Iranian military has.
Would you be able to talk about the prophetic significance of this and then also just let listeners know where they could go to read more about it in that context?
Yeah, certainly. We do follow Iran quite closely because Iran, as anyone that watches the news knows, Iran is a very aggressive international actor. And there has been a massive campaign in the United States ever since the nuclear deal was being pushed by the Obama media to try and downplay that threat. And actually in 2015, when these war games were going on, this was a couple of weeks after the nuclear deal was agreed upon, and they dragged out the aircraft carrier of the United States and started destroying it again. And so really through this whole period, though Iran might have been painted by your media as a party that can be negotiated into compliance with Western values, that's not the case. And the Bible indicates that that is not going to be the case as well going forward. There's a prophecy found in Daniel chapter 11, an end time prophecy, and it details the events leading up to the final great war, or great tribulation, as the Bible calls it. And it really starts off with this belligerent, pushy foreign policy actor. And we've talked about that being Iran, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, has talked about that being Iran. It's known in the Bible as the King of the South, and he's written a book by that title, The King of the South, that will explain this prophecy greatly for everybody. And in that prophecy, it talks about the King of the South having the power to push at other international actors. And in that prophecy specifically, it is going to make a push at European nations. And so when we see the increase with Iranian military technology, it really does show how Iran is gaining the power to make that prophesied push and push us closer again to that war to end all wars. Again, you can read The King of the South for more details on that.
Brent has also written an article on thetrumpet.com. It's called In First, Iran Launches Ballistic Missiles from Underground. So you can also check that out to understand more about this. Thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, for our next story here, we'll shift gears a little bit and talk about Belarus, where on Wednesday, authorities announced that they had arrested 33 militants that they say were there plotting a terrorist attack on the country that was said to have been timed to disrupt Belarus ahead of some presidential elections that are coming up in about a week. So these militants are part of Russia's quasi-private military contractor outfit. It's called the Wagner Group. And the Wagner Group is very powerful. It really acts as Putin's invisible hand in places like Venezuela, Syria, Libya, Sudan, Ukraine. These guys have built Russia's largest troll farm, the Internet Research Agency. They've been known to interfere with elections in various Western countries. They've also assassinated numerous important people. They've even taken over strategic territories, including playing a role in Russia's annexation of Crimea and its destabilization there in the eastern parts of Ukraine. And of course, since the Wagner Group is not an official wing of the Russian military, it's able to do all of this and accomplish so many of Russia's political interests while still letting Vladimir Putin maintain plausible deniability. So this is arguably the world's most effective mercenary army, and you can see why the Belarusians were just alarmed to discover dozens of their operatives in Belarus. And Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko did call an emergency meeting about this on Wednesday just to try to figure out exactly what their goal was. And so far, Lukashenko is sticking to his claims that they were there to orchestrate an attack in order to destabilize the country before presidential elections that are scheduled for August 9th. But there's reason, really, for us to take a closer look at Belarus's story of what happened here, because there are some problems with it. You know, if this proved to be true, that Putin was planning a secret attack on his closest ally, which Belarus is to Russia, and that Putin was doing it possibly to remove Lukashenko from power, that would be huge news. But the trouble is that from Putin's point of view, there's really not a viable replacement for Lukashenko right now, who would be as loyal to Putin as Lukashenko has been for 20 years now. Lukashenko has actually ruled Belarus for 26 years. So he was in power before Putin even took the reins back in 99-2000. And he has made Belarus just a loyal vassal to Moscow. And he's received all kinds of subsidized Russian energy in exchange for it. Now, it is true that in the last 5 or 6 years, the ties between Russia and Belarus have suffered. Lukashenko was spooked by what happened with Ukraine back in 2014. That made him really rethink some of the dependence that Belarus has on Russia, and it made him try to build closer ties with the West. But despite all this, Putin has still been able to manage Lukashenko, and Lukashenko is still the best option for the Kremlin to have in power in Belarus. So that really means that Russia would have no motive for a terrorist attack on its closest ally. What it looks like has actually happened here is that these Russian mercenaries with the Wagner Group were on their way to Libya or Sudan or Syria. Those are all nations where the Wagner Group has ongoing operations. And there were some photos made public of the arrest of these individuals. Lukashenko made sure to make it all a very public display. And the photos showed that many of these men had Sudanese money and Sudanese telephone cards and texts written in Arabic. So it looks like they were only using Belarus as a transit point on their way to Africa. But Lukashenko decided to kind of use the specter of foreign influence to improve his chances of winning this August 9th election. Lukashenko is famous for fear-mongering about foreign influence, just to kind of paint himself as the best man, the man best situated to protect Belarus. And I think with this Wagner Group situation, he's trying to send a message to voters saying Belarus could go the way of Ukraine if they don't re-elect him. So we don't know for sure at this point, but when you consider who has what motive, it really looks like this is just a political ploy by Lukashenko, and maybe one that he didn't think through very well. So it looks like this particular incident may not be a case of Vladimir Putin working to take over Belarus, but the trumpet has been watching Putin and his maneuvers with Belarus very closely. And that's largely because Belarus was part of the Soviet Union. It was there along with Georgia and Ukraine and 11 other republics, all under Russia's power. And early in his presidency, Putin called the collapse of that Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. So he looks back fondly on the era when Russia had all those countries forged into one under the Soviet hammer. And one of his highest priorities as leader of Russia has been to hammer as much of it as possible back into place. You know, we've seen that with Georgia, we've seen it with Ukraine. And as for Belarus, it's already largely forged into Russia, but only in an unofficial way. And it could be that Putin will very soon try to make that official once again. And earlier this year, there was an episode of The Trumpet Daily given by Mr. Andrew Loker. It's called Why You Need to Watch Vladimir Putin and Belarus in 2020. And he goes into quite a lot of detail there about the prophecies about Vladimir Putin. So we will leave a link to that episode of The Trumpet Daily in the show notes. And we'll also leave a link to an article we have called Soviet Reunion, Russia and Belarus Push Toward Common State. For our final story today, we'll head back to the USA, where liberals were extremely upset that President Donald Trump was able to confirm 2 justices to the Supreme Court, and they said that the court's rulings would be illegitimate in their view. But the court has actually been making a number of rulings lately that liberals were very pleased about, including one this week that favors casinos over churches. For this, we'll turn again to Andrew.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has just been making just horrible ruling after horrible ruling. This last Friday, it ruled that a Nevada church's request that churches be held to the same standards as casinos in regards to coronavirus quarantine was not something it was going to uphold or consider. Specifically in Nevada, they've allowed casinos and movie theaters to have up to 500-600 people gathered in a building, even amidst their coronavirus quarantine lockdowns. And yet, for a church, they've said you can't have more than 50. And so they took that to the Supreme Court, and there's definitely those who will argue, and even persuasively argue, that the lockdowns themselves are unconstitutional, given that the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of assembly. Although whether or not that's true, it's definitely a very hypocritical double standard and a violation of the First Amendment to allow a casino to have 500-600 people in a building, but a church can only have a tenth of that. It says, yeah, Congress will make no law regarding the establishment of religion. And they're saying here, they're like, whether the lockdowns are constitutional or not, you're definitely singling out churches for harsher treatment than movie theaters or casinos or other types of institutions.
Yeah, that is truly a bizarre double standard. It's hard to believe that something like that was able to pass through. Would you be able just briefly to put this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Yeah, well, when you're looking at how this ruling broke down, I mean, the four liberal judges voted that it was okay to discriminate against the churches, plus John Roberts, who pretty much always votes for the liberals these days. Neil Gorsuch wrote the dissent, but it just does show that there's just this bias, like societal bias, that's growing against religion, and they're even throwing out the law, the supreme law of the land, in order to do this discrimination against churches. And it does bring to mind that prophecy in Isaiah 1 verses 4 through 7 that talks about the whole head is sick and the whole heart is faint. And in the Isaiah's End Time booklet, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory, he points out that phrase head really refers to the government. It's the government of end time Israel, the government of America, and the whole government is just sick, and there's just no soundness in it. And it is easy to overlook that sometimes right now, especially because the Trump administration has made some strides towards upholding the rule of law in America, but that's just one man in a small inner circle kind of holding back this much bigger tsunami of just lawless government officials in the deep state and in the government bureaucracies and in Congress and in the court systems. And so now, even despite those two justices you mentioned that the Trump administration has appointed, and both those justices he appointed agreed that this decision on churches and casinos is a horrible decision, but it's still you've got so many judges in the federal judiciary who just have this lawless do whatever's expedient agenda that decisions like this continue to happen despite the Trump administration's appointees.
We have an article up on thetrumpet.com. It's called Supreme Court Favors Casinos Over Churches. So please check our show notes for that and for all the other literature that we've discussed today. Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. And we'll leave you today with the words of Robert Frost. Don't ever take a fence down until you know why it was put up. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.